Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 72, where we are discussing a 1976 article by Marvin Weisbord, Organizational Diagnosis, Six Places to Look for Trouble with or Without a Theory, published in the journal Group and Organization Management. This is part one of the episode where we will describe Weisbord's famous six-box model of organizational diagnosis introduced in the text. Hi, this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Ralph speaking to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico, also in the United States.
And this is Michael coming to you from Utrecht in lockdown in the Netherlands.
Lockdown.
We're all in lockdown.
But this is also during this big nor'easter that hit the eastern United States. So it's lockdown in Muddle Boys. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You guys absolutely got all the snow. That's right. Yeah. Environmental lockdown.
So anyway, today we're going to definitely take a different track because in recent episodes, we've been concentrating on organization theory, management science. I mean, definitely a lot more of the higher end academic materials. Today, we're diving into the world of organizational development consulting. This is now very much the practical side. And the reason why we wanted to do this is because there is so much work that's been done in the consulting field for so long of trying to take what is the, you know, the greatest, latest information about org theory and apply it to real organizations in a way that can be packaged and reused in multiple contexts. And so what we did was we chose Marvin Weisbord's six-box model as the topic of conversation today. And the article that we chose is from a group in the journal Group and Organization Management. It's Marvin Weisbord's Organizational Diagnosis, Six Places to Look for Trouble with or Without a Theory. And it was published back in 1976. It's a fairly short article, very easy to read, but it also was kind of the precursor or announcement to a book that Marvin would write later, just a couple of years later, called Organizational Diagnosis, which uses the six-box model, what became known as the six-box model that's presented in this particular article as well. This model is used as a tool to help not just consultants, but just layman members of an organization try to figure out not just what's wrong, but what are the sources behind what's wrong. Marvin Weisbord himself had a very illustrious career. I mean, by the time that he had published this article, he had already spent a couple of decades serving as an organizational development consultant. He was a consultant from 1969 all the way to 1992. And he had joined with a couple of fellow consultants to form a consulting firm, Block, Petrella, and Weisbord, and a training company, Designed Learning. Hundreds of projects that stemmed from that. And he would also produce a couple of other books, Productive Workplaces and Productive Workplaces Revisited, which Ralph and I both read as part of our doctoral program. And it was surprising in a way to look back at not just his bio, but also to understand that his initial influence was Douglas McGregor's The Human Side of Enterprise. And that was a big part of the book, Productive Workplaces, that we read. So in a lot of ways, he took what was some significant theoretical works and he tried to bring it to practice. So with that, I'd like to just kind of open the floor for initial thoughts about this article and about the six-box model that it presents.
Well, I think the title is a little I don't say misleading is the right way to say it, but he understates the title a little bit, with or without a theory, because he does talk about it, the theories that he bases the model on. And it's good. It's good to have some ideas about why to look deeper in certain areas and how the boxes are constructed. So it's not entirely theory-less, but maybe that makes it more approachable, or it's a more interesting title as a result. So I'm not criticizing that title, just to make sure our listeners understand. There are quite a few theories that he refers to in the article, so don't look down on it because he uses that phraseology in the title. And he uses the metaphor several times in the article of a radar display. And for people who haven't seen a radar display, it's essentially usually a circular, or could be square. And it shows other vessels or airplanes or things moving about in relation to you. And he talks about the model being a way to identify contacts or things to investigate further. That's how we say it in the Navy, a contact. And I think that's really a good way to do it, because it gives you this potential for an overview of the organization through the six boxes, and where you might look for difficulties and the questions you might ask. That's the other thing I think is really interesting. He gives quite a bit of good insight in the questions that will help you learn more, and not just consultants. That certainly was part of the focus, but also just people within the organization having a better understanding of how their organization is organized to do the things it does and how it relates to its environment.
I agree, Ralph. I mean, the article is directed to a diverse public, you might say, to consultants, but also to practitioners, to managers, other people within organizations. But at the end of the article, he also stresses like the usefulness of his model for students, for instance. I think that's good with the article, that he tries to connect to different audiences. Yet it also kind of makes it a bit of ambivalent, the article. It's not always clear if he's actually talking about or directing a statement towards consultants when he's explaining the model, or more to people within the organization. And this is not always very explicit in the article, which can be a bit confusing maybe to some listeners. But in the end, I think it's a very good article connected to real life situations in organizations, very oriented toward practitioners. I like the holistic approach he takes. It's a model, a framework that really tries to get a grip on the whole of the organizations and the elements within that. Also, the relations he stresses between different factors and elements within organizations. So it's not only focusing on people or rewards or purposes, but also the connections between these elements. And I think he does a good job in trying to tackle these the problems that could exist between the within these relations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, of course, we also recognize that this was written in 1976. That came at a time before a whole, you know, the consulting industry really developed, and you started to see, like, I think, Ralph, you and I have probably been exposed to several different management systems and tools and other mechanisms, you know, some of them very, very complex. And this, you know, those are those essentially take a lot of the same ideas that Wiseboard presents, but, you know, tries to be a lot more accurate, I guess, would be the best way to put it. You know, there's you try to get much deeper into the different factors. So this was sort of like at the front edge of what would become a very significant movement in business consulting, trying to come up with a tool that you can apply to multiple organizations. So I guess in some way, I think, it may be that the title was a way of trying to say, hey, look, this is not about, you know, I'm not looking to try to make you a theorist, or I'm trying not to cater to academics or practitioners. I'm trying to bridge the both by trying to present stuff that comes from theory, but is to put into what I would consider to be very definitely plain language. And in some ways, I think consulting systems, models, whatever that came after this in the quest for more accuracy, I think sometimes depart from this nice plain language feel in trying to explain what are you looking at, what kind of questions do you ask, et cetera.
Well, I think that was part of his design. I think Michael was spot on when he talked about there's a bit of ambiguity in the article, because it's written at a high level. And I think that's, on the one hand, good, and it's also makes it difficult, because it's maybe there are times when you'd have difficulty understanding, well, what exactly is he talking about here? But he writes at a high enough level that you can look for problems, and practitioners can look for problems. And I thought it was interesting because it was written for both practitioners of consulting and practitioners inside the workplace. You could make the argument that there are enough opportunities to find problems that you could keep it high level, and it'll just depend on what you see and the kinds of questions you ask. And one of the things I kept thinking as I was reading about, he describes the six boxes as a cognitive map of organizations, which I think is also a very good metaphor, basically a way to think about the thinking and activities that go on in the organization. So Tom, you're right. You have to keep in mind that this is a very early article, not long after the seminal works that he's quoting. And he's synthesizing all these things to make them usable and accessible to people, but also with theory. And I've worked in all three of the kinds of organizations he references in the article: the functional, the project-based, or the, and then the mixed group. I've been in all of those different kinds of organizations. And many times when I was reading, I was thinking, oh yeah, we had that problem, or yeah, this was a difficult. And in fact, I know we'll get a little further into this into the article, but he was talking about, I think it was Michael, maybe it was you that was talking about the connections between the boxes, which I always find the most interesting parts of organizations. Sure, inside a box or inside some functional part of the organization, that's moderately interesting. But the really interesting stuff happens between the boxes. One of the things I always did when I was working in organizations, and I was a little bit before I was exposed to the six-box model, although I just hadn't seen this article, is I would look for those things that looked like they were missing between the organizations. What isn't supposed to be happening? Where are those difficulties occur? And then I would try to find ways I could assist with those, because in many of the assignments I had, I didn't have a really particular job in the organization. My job was to be there to learn or to assist in these various places. And so that's about as much guidance as I got. And looking for what happened between the functional parts of the organization, or what seemed to be missing in the extra connective tissue, as it were, gave me things to work on and ways to contribute to the organization when I didn't always have a formal role.
Maybe we should go into the boxes now first before we go into the relations between the boxes. What do you think?
I completely agree.
Yeah, especially because that's basically one of the things that you're shown in a nice diagram on the third page. It's right out in front. Let me just, for everyone's audience's benefit, to list the six boxes, and then we'll pick and choose and decide where we want to go. But the six boxes are different factors that are essential for the organization to run. The first one is purposes. What business are we in? That's like your mission. Structure. How do we divide up the work? Okay, that's pretty straightforward. Third, rewards. Do all needed tasks have incentives? That is, are the workers incentivized properly to do the work that they are assigned? Fourth is relationships. How do we manage conflict among people with technologies? So you kind of see how the division of labor can create conflict. What do you do about it? And then the fifth one is helpful mechanisms. How are we adequately coordinating technologies, which this is, of course, the organizational science construct of technology. What we're talking about here is how do we coordinate processes, systems, all of the informal mechanisms. Now, these five are arranged in a circle around the sixth box, which is leadership. Does someone keep the boxes in balance? And the five around the outside of the circle are all kind of connected to each other, and leadership just sits there in the center. So those are the six boxes. Which one of these, any one of these, or all six of them, are very important in some way, but which one do we want to explore first?
Well, I recommend going through them in roughly the order he uses in the article, just because it's a little more straightforward that way. And I would begin with purpose, which is interesting. I do want to come back to the structure part that Tom says, very straightforward, because as we know, it actually isn't always as straightforward as you might like it to be. I know Tom meant that partly tongue-in-cheek, and also partly with there's more to say there. And one of the things that's very interesting about purposes is it sounds really clear. Oh, it's just about how we, what we're here for. But it's interesting that many times organizations don't understand their purpose, or people get so tied up around their functional role or their job description or what have you, that they lose sight of the purpose of the larger organization. And Deming would often talk about sub-optimizing individual processes, and Weisbord talks a little bit about that when he talks about functional organizations. Essentially, he refers to the purpose as the two kinds of fit, which I thought was really an interesting way to think about it. The fit between the organization and the environment. You can't ignore the environment. And he does have a little bit of open systems architecture description in the article. And also the fit between the individual and the organization. And both of those are aspects of culture, which I thought was really a good way to say it, particularly the part about individual and the organization. And many times in organizations, you can have a person who's not a good fit in their particular role, in the role they're in. So as a leader, you have a choice of saying, well, do I want to change the role so it fits that person better? Or do I need to move them to a different role because that role needs to be as it is, and that person just isn't going to function well in that role? Some organizations have more or less flexibility in that area, but I just thought that idea of fit was a really good way to think about the purpose of the organization.
Yeah, I agree. This is also a point that I wanted to stress, that when he discusses the box of purpose, he also says, well, purpose is not something that's going to be decided by only managers and members. It's also going to be decided by the environment, right? So that's where the open systems perspective is very clear in his narrative. And then later on in this section, he introduces three diagnostic questions, one of them related very much to the fit on the environment you mentioned. So it's a goal fit. Is this organization's purpose valued by society, and will people pay for it? And goal agreement. To what extent do people understand and support the organization's purpose? And I take it not only the people within the organization, but also external audiences. And I think it's kind of interesting that this article, being from 1976, is actually situated within the beginnings of institutional theory as well. Like in 1977, you get the works of Zucker and Meyer and Rowan, and then a few years later, you get DiMaggio and Powell. In a way, the time was right to put the environment center stage, you might say. Yet I don't think we should not interpret Weisbord as a contributor to the institutional theory, not at all. But I like it very much that he puts an eye on the legitimating function, I would say, on the of the environment in his diagnostic model.
Oh, definitely. And these questions are ones that I think, especially once you get to large, complex organizations, these are the sorts of questions that just continuously come up and dog an organization, because you can think about like one as large as an international conglomerate or a military organization, or whatever, where, you know, at a certain level, the purpose of the organization is simple, you know, can be expressed simply and clearly. But underneath it, the divisions, the different functional divisions or hierarchical divisions, you can have the purpose being diffuse or misunderstood. Sometimes the stated purpose of the whole organization doesn't translate down to the lowest level. And so, you know, organizations can be confused as to, you know, how are they contributing to the overall goal if it's just cognitively so distant away from what you're trying to do on a day-to-day basis. And I also like what you said about the internal environment. Basically, goal agreement, to an extent, do people understand and support the organization's purposes? A lot of times, I think what happens is that the organization, because it is so busy and because it's doing so much of a churn, tries to force feed it from the top, as opposed to allowing, you know, some conversations to happen at the bottom if you start to have issues with goal agreement. So a very, very thoughtful way of approaching purpose, because it would be so easy to just stop at the mission statement and say, that's it. That's our purpose. You know, done. Next box.
Right. Well, not only that, but then people say, okay, well, we know the purpose, but the actions that we take don't translate well to it or don't fit it very well. I can't tell you how many times I was in organizations where people would have a different understanding. I think that's what you were alluding to, Tom. It's one thing to, you know, describe the purpose, but then you people put it into action and they would have this different purpose. And there are some days I wonder, are we in the same organization or do we have the same purpose? Because your understanding is so much different than mine. And I tried not to take the approach, well, okay, you must not know it, and try to understand as I got a little bit more experience, okay, what am I missing here? What am I not understanding? And then I think a follow on to what Michael was talking about, internal operation of the organization and matching it to the external, is this notion of formal and informal systems. That is brilliant. This idea that you could have one thing on paper or one thing in the way the Boxer diagram, and that's how I initially approached organizations when I was a junior officer in the Navy, was every organization. The Navy has an organization chart, in the Navy, they call it the Standard Organization and Regulations Manual. And it just describes, here's what people do. Here's what they're responsible for. So I thought, okay, that's what you're supposed to do. And then I noticed, yeah, but that's not really what they do. Or they're doing different things. Or you could do these things and still not be successful. I was amazed the number of times I noted that if you did everything that's on the piece of paper that says that's how you contribute to the mission, you could still fail, or the organization could still fail. And the people who do safety analysis, they have another way of describing the informal and formal. They say work as described versus, or work as imagined, either way. Sometimes the description is an imagination of how the work should be done, and then work is actually performed. And that is very similar, I would say, to what Wiseboard's talking about. And also in this section, he talks about how to actually collect data, which is really important in this article. A lot of it is observing what people do, asking them questions, reading these written texts, and also surveys as well, which are not so easy to do in the military. But you can do informal surveys, which is functionally interviewing quite a few people. And I used to do that all the time because surveys were hard, not easy to implement for informal or lower in the organization. But I do think that the concept of the informal and formal processes and organization is really important.
Yeah, he talks about what people say and what people do, right? But I really, really like the idea of the imagined and the performed work that you just introduced, Ralph. That's interesting. Another way of looking at it. Yeah, cool.
Okay, so the second box was structure, and he opened the section with in organizations as an architecture, form follows function. Every structure is good for something, but no one is good for everything. And that's a very telling point because structure is, in a way, it's an attempt to divide the labor, but it also represents some cultural artifacts that feed into the organization. And as we all know, organizations tend to depart from its formal structure over time. And it becomes interesting to see when they diverge to the point where they get completely misaligned. And he sort of alludes to that by presenting, when he presents us, as you mentioned, Ralph, the form functional, the product, and the matrixed organization as, the fundamental structures that organizations will tend to, formally organize themselves around, but then to what extent does it really adhere to that structure, and does that introduce the problems that we're trying to diagnose?
Well, and not only that, Tom, one of the big challenges here is the way Wiseboard writes the article, which is not a criticism, it's just something for people to be aware of. He writes as if the organization and its leaders were completely in charge of those things, that structure and the purposes. And in many organizations, that's not so. You're either a division of a larger group or a multinational, I think as Tom was talking about, or you're part of the military or the government where you actually, that your mission is handed to you. And you're not allowed to say, well, I think we ought to be working on this other thing over here. Or that's very difficult to get people to recognize that. And I was in organizations where we were structured, I think, reasonably well for what our purpose was on paper. But what I noticed was there was a huge mismatch with the environment because customers or people who took our outputs wanted us to be organized completely differently or do things that were completely different than the way we were organized. And it was not usually a very fulfilling conversation because I couldn't just say, well, okay, you want that, but these other guys want this other thing, and these guys want a third thing. And those were very difficult to reconcile, and it was a very difficult conversation to have with people. But I do think it's important to recognize that mismatch occurs, so at least you can talk about it. And I think one of the things that was also interesting in this section is he talks about the product and projects organizations. It was really in one sentence, but I think it's really important, and that is that the functional organizations, he doesn't say this exactly, but it's pretty close. The functional organizations, they're the ones responsible for providing the expertise that you need in product and project teams, that people just don't show up knowing how to do the various functions. They've got some parent part of the organization that helps make sure they have the right skills. And that exchange of skills and expertise and training, preparing people, is really, really important. And so he only has really one sentence in there about people becoming de-skilled over time. You could write a whole paper on that. And I'm not criticizing the article. I think it's just worth noticing that there's lots more detail there and a lot of really interesting things you can understand if you get into the details of that.
Yeah, something similar we could say for maybe the Matrix organization as well. I mean, he does stress some difficulties in working in such a kind of Matrix organization. He also kind of seems not very positive about the Matrix structure. But you could also say, well, it's just a few paragraphs that he writes on it. While there is, it's a very complex organizational structure that's maybe an article in itself. And I think many of our listeners, and also we have worked or do work in matrix organizations. And one of the basic elements of working in such a structure is that you have two bosses, right? So you got your project boss and your functional boss, and
sometimes it's more than two. It's at least two, but sometimes it's more. I've been in an organization where I had three or four bosses. It's very challenging.
How do you deal with that with four bosses, Ralph?
Yeah, it was a challenge. So it was ship overhaul, and I had the commanding officer of the ship, I had the commanding officer of my organization, and I had a dual reporting responsibility to the program office in Washington, D.C. And then many times, the executive officer who worked for the commanding officer, he had completely different ideas. So he was a different boss. And so the conflicts would usually come up over, well, why can't you do this or why that can't be done? So what I would usually refer to is, well, here's what the regulations are, or here's what the law requires. And that would usually help me with them. But then when I was having different parts asking for different things, sometimes I basically had to go to my direct reporting boss and say, I'm stuck. I've got these different people asking for different things. And I would say, here's what I think I should be prioritizing. Here's what I think I should do. But help me understand if I don't have it right. Because at some level, you have to default to the person who signs your evaluations. That's the way I would look at it then. But I desperately needed the cooperation of those other members. And occasionally, I didn't do what they wanted and basically would get a shellacking, but I would just apologize and move on and be sincere about it. Honestly, I mean, it wasn't just, I think they would be able to tell lack of sincerity. So I think prior to it was, you know, make sure I couldn't get fired for violating the law or a financial regulation. That was number one. And then number two, when I saw the demands being irreconcilable, I'd go to my boss and say, here's what I'm going to have to say to this person and give him a chance to overrule me. And then I would be able to go to that third or fourth boss and say, I can't do this because I'm required to do this, and then make sure my boss knew. So they weren't always happy, but I did have one of them come back to me later and say, you know, I thought you should be fired like five or six times, but then I realized later you were just trying to balance all the requirements of the different people. So I changed my mind, and I thought, okay, somebody coming to me later and saying he wanted to fire me, but thought, later he realized it wasn't a good idea. I thought, that's pretty good. That's pretty good praise. I could live with that. So that's the way I dealt with it.
Yes, it sounds like there's a lot of politics on personal level. I think that's exactly the thing that he not takes into account in this section.
I think you're right, Michael, that he skips over that stuff. Yeah. And I would say it's non-trivial, those kinds of aspects. So he just alludes to them. And so I don't know whether it's you would call this the ambiguity you refer to later, or basically he simplifies that. And I know, okay, it's a 14-page article, as Tom said, so can't get into everything. But you're spot on, Michael. That is where the really interesting and challenging stuff comes in, because people's personalities and agendas can be so different. And I occasionally was accused of having the wrong agenda or not realizing who my boss was. Okay, I try to take that constructively and look at the larger picture of the organization and try to see their point. But that's not so easy to do. I wasn't a saint and therefore not perfect at it.
Yeah. Now that does get into the next section, which was relationships, because this is where the politics sort of comes in. And I think what he was trying to do, in a way, he's trying to not just make the model simple, but he's also trying to make it rational, I think. I think he's trying to not mute, but trying to get the consultant to think away from the the real deeper politics and just try to look rationally what's going on. So just look at the relationships between people, between units, between the people and their technologies, all of the things that he lists in here from a rational perspective, and try to take the politics out or put it on a shelf or characterize it in a rational fashion. If you allow the politics to color the consultant, then you can get a biased appraisal of what's wrong and, therefore a bad fix. In a way, it was a way of trying to address it without addressing it so directly. So I guess we sort of covered that one. We can just kind of move on to the rewards, which we did a whole podcast episode on some time ago with Stephen Kerr and reward system. But this definitely is an interesting piece because he brings in Maslow, he brings in Hertzberg's hygiene factors, his two-factor theory, brought a lot of things to think about. How is the fit, say, between the person and the organization, and how is the fit between the organization and the environment? I mean, what incentivizes the right fit?
Right. Well, he even talks about merit pay, which I think is pretty amazing for 1976, even raising that as an issue. And then there's this really important notion, and he identifies it very quickly in that section, and it's this idea of fairness. So, you think you might be doing it as fair as you know how, but if other people don't agree with you or they don't see it as fair, then it doesn't matter what your reward system is. It's not going to be effective if people perceive inequities, and that can be very challenging. I was in an organization where you had the ability, I thought it was a really interesting process. You had the ability to reward groups of people in the project or related to the project for getting something really useful done. You had a local level. We had some fairly large budget for it. You could give them cash awards. Government has that. Or you could give them, which is something you couldn't do in the military, but you could do it with civilians. And you could give them, I think, some kind of forget there was a name for these things, but it was some kind of gift, like a water bottle or a small bag or a briefcase or something like that, of nominal value, because it met all the government ethics requirements. And so what I would do is I never knew all the people who were involved. So I would go to the people who I worked most closely with and said, I want to submit an award. Give me a list of who the people are. And it was actually very easy to write the justification for the award. And they got approved very quickly. There was some committee that approved them. Every single time I did this, somebody would come and say, well, I should have got an award. I contributed to that. And to me, that never bothered me. I just thought, I don't know the details. I don't know if I missed them or not. I just added them. It was easy to do. And I had an associate at the shipyard. He said he never submitted those awards. It was an interesting approach. He said he never submitted those awards because he didn't want to deal with that kind of arguing later about who should or shouldn't get it. So to him, that was a waste of time. And therefore, he didn't do them at all, which is a different approach entirely. To me, that's throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as we say in the U.S., basically ignoring the benefits for a small problem. But people can have different ideas. One last thing I want to say before we get some extra input here is I looked at the box and rewards, and before I even read the section, I circled the box and wrote incentivized or incentives. How are people incentivized? Because that is not a small issue. It is amazing the number of times you see in organizations, people are actually incentivized to do the exact opposite of what you want, or things that you, maybe not the exact opposite, but things they're incentivized to do, execute behaviors that aren't helpful to the overall organization, and people don't see that. So I just love that idea of the rewards and incentives, because people respond very strongly to incentives. And you're probably familiar that there's some organizational theory research that says there is no incentive, there is no reward that cannot be gamed. Every kind of incentive system or reward system can be gamed, because people figure out what you want and they figure out how to get there.
And I really liked that he brought in Hertzberg's factors, because it also brings in a whole different way of thinking about incentives, because the tendency sometimes is to think of incentives that are the tangible benefits that we confer for a particular reason and not think about the things like the sense of belonging. I mean, what incentivizes commitment to the organization that gets an individual to like being here or to feel like it's better to be here than to go somewhere else. Because sometimes...
Or feel like they're valued, right? Or feel like they're valued. Because I imagine you had the same challenge in the Army that I did in the Navy, in that you couldn't give extra money as an incentive to the people who were on active duty. That's not possible. So you had to get pretty creative about the things you're just talking about, how to translate those into non-monetary activities and short of giving days off. I mean, you could always do that, but that's, there are some people that say, well, you're incentivizing the person not to work. I mean, why would you want that? So that's one view. And I think that's one of the challenges. If you take that off the table, you have to get pretty creative about how to incentivize or reward people when money is not possible.
But you also have to consider what happens when what the organization considers to be appropriate commitment versus what is motivating for the individual. And I can imagine, you know, a lot of organizations where duty, loyalty is sort of like the expectation. And that only carries so far if...
Right. I'm sure you heard the same thing I did. When I first came in the Navy, you would hear people say, well, why give that guy an award? He's just doing his job.
Exactly.
I heard that many times. And that is actually... And you have these waves in the military where sometimes you can get awards from just showing up. And we actually do have awards just like that. And then other times, you have to save somebody's life to get an award. It's amazing the way the pendulum swings.
Yeah, kind of like the pendulum swing between giving a trophy for champions versus giving a participation trophy
right.
Now, I find it interesting that Wiseboard decided to cover leadership next, as opposed to completing the circle with the helpful mechanisms. So. Yeah, so a lot of what he talks about leadership. I mean, this is he talks about the system 4 and system 1. The autocratic versus the participation among Likert. He sort of introduces that. He also brought in a couple of other theories. What he sort of settles in on is that it's essentially the fit between the leadership style and the organization. He breaks out 4 leadership tasks, and I'll just list them out here really quickly. Defining purposes, embodying purposes and programs, defending institutional integrity, and ordering internal conflict, which, of course, they're essential leadership functions. We would assume those in any context, but they're also very personality dependent. And what he seems to allude to here is that, if you have a mismatch or a misfit between the leader and the organization's culture in terms of how these tasks are performed, then you could basically exacerbate a lot of problems.
I think that's an interesting point that he raises, that you can, as a leader, really exacerbate existing problems. And to me, it's just above these the 4 styles. That I think it's 2 paragraphs above. He says something like, well, this issue is not very well understood. And then he stresses that interpersonal skills are most functional in unstructured, ambiguous, and or high anxiety situations. And that as a leader, you can really make a difference there. As a leader, you can really use those personal skills to smooth, he says, ruffled feathers. The skills contribute little to organizational performance in the absence of goal clarity and goal agreement. And that's where he makes this relationship between the elements in the box. That's where I was thinking, yes, right? It's not only about the leadership style. It's very much related in this sense to the purposes of the organization as well. That's what Tom just introduced as well. It's the style of the leadership style fit with the organization or its organization's purpose. And he actually kind of makes this point that you can be a very thoughtful leader, connected to your team, to your persons, but that are working with you. But if there's total unclarity about the goal of the team or the goal of the organization, it doesn't matter if you're a good leader or have a good fit or a good style as a leader. It's about the fit of your leadership style to the organization's purpose. And I think that's a relevant point to raise.
Yeah, I think that's really important, Michael, to emphasize that, because you see some people who have really one preferred style. I mean, and there's quite a bit of literature on that people have fallen in several camps. What I noticed as a leader in organizations was you actually had to adapt your style for just that reason, just what you were talking about, that idea that sometimes a different style is needed to get goal clarity. And sometimes you had to be, it was good to listen to people, But in the final analysis, very few organizations are democracies. So you had to say, this is what we're going to do. I've listened to you. And in fact, I think it's important that you validate with people, okay, what their interest was, so they feel heard. But at the end of the day, many organizations, they just want clarity. They want to understand, well, what am I supposed to do? And you one level it translates it, then just tell me what to do, which is sort of the antithesis of knowledge work. But you do get that. And I think without goal clarity, you can be the nicest, most approachable person, but you're just going to have chaos, like you were talking about that relationship. Or I think the other thing, what I was thinking when you were talking about that relationships and how the work connects to the environment, I was thinking about the fact that many leaders don't understand more than just what they do to something or some part of the process that goes through. They understand their process really well, but they don't understand the whole process. So that's where you get the sub-optimization of process, or people feel like they're not responsible for what happens later. And yet that's a source of all sorts of difficulties, as you mentioned, that relationship between the boxes and how a thing, and it might not be a thing, it might be something less tangible, like leadership, flows through the organization as the activities contribute to it. I think that's really important. And I think you emphasize that very well, Michael.
Yeah, I agree. And this is also something that I think is important as we think, just forward to the present. A lot of the things that he talked about is stuff that we almost assume now in terms of what leadership does. I mean, it would just seem obvious that the leader should define purposes. But That can be challenging depending on the environment. And certainly what I read into this section is that there's leaders have responsibilities up and out and down and in. Sometimes the challenge, especially where he talks later about the fit between the leader and the organization, is that there always is that pressure to try to focus more up and out the higher up in the organization you are, or the larger the organization is, therefore what the role of the leader becomes. Up and out becomes, at the expense of down and in. Down and in is what you end up delegating. And then when you have internal conflict that becomes unmanageable to the point of crisis, to the point of embarrassment, to the point of something else, then I don't want to say it's too late, but it's really challenges the type of people that we wind up putting into leadership positions if we train them, if we train whole series of leaders to think of themselves as being the up and out, the face of the franchise. And then the situation dictates that we need to train and educate leaders to be down and in kind of people. That's not an easy thing to fix.
I agree with you. And I think that's a great point that you get some people, the lesson they take away from leadership is, okay, I need to be an up and out guy because that's what's important. That's what affects my career, those kinds of things. And they underemphasize the down and in part. And what I was thinking about when both you and Michael were talking about the leadership and the functions is that, and Weisbord doesn't discuss it, but I do think it's an interesting idea. So I'll just a little bit of an extension. Is this idea that when the leader doesn't fit for not just the organization, but also the environment and the situation the organization is in, that's when you start thinking about firing the leader. Because if one of the questions, it never gets said out loud, but it's one of these things where I suspect senior leaders are asking, can the organization get better with Ralph at the helm? Does Ralph have the skills, as he demonstrating, he's got the down and in capability to focus on these crises or these great difficulties to improve the organization? And if he doesn't, then there's no reason for him to be there. And even as a leader, you have to say the same thing when you're doing down and in. If I've got somebody in this group and they can't get better with this person in charge, I need to rethink what I had that person doing. And that's not an easy thing to do. And a lot of times people shy away from making those kinds of choices, but they're very important. And so that's why I think this idea of the fit between the leader and the organization and the context are really important. And we probably don't pay enough attention to that in organizational theory as we should.
Yeah. Now, this is another area where politics of a different sort can kind of come in as well, because I know I've in a separate podcast episode, I talked about sort of like the coaching change metaphor, where the change out of the leadership is as much symbol as it is, assessment of the leadership within the organization, which can do wonders for, say, a team that is a sports team that is not doing as well as expected, but can also have the reverse effect of what you want and drive an organization even further down.
Yeah, I've often wondered when they replace the head man in an organization or a coach or something like that, and the players don't really change, if that really makes a significant difference in the short term. It maybe does, probably does in the long term, but in the short term, or it's like you said, Tom, where it's a signal that you send to the organization how seriously you take the situation and the fact that their leadership needs to be removed. Because it's pretty shocking when you work in an organization. I've been there before. When the leader, the head person gets fired, that's pretty shocking and really gets your attention about the difficulties. And so I suspect many times in organizations that happens, maybe even if you think that they could get better with the leader, but maybe not fast enough, or maybe you just need to send a very strong signal because there's an aspect of that very strong behavior that is an important signal that I think we really need to understand better. That how that motivates people or changes the way they think, because organizations in crisis often need that to get people's attention.
We now turn to the last box, which is helpful mechanisms. We're kind of back into that ring of five boxes. And this is basically the procedures, the policies, all of the things, the cultural artifacts, all of the ways of doing business, I think, is a good summary of it. That connect everything together, that basically, all right, once we've established the divisions of labor, we establish incentives, whatever, this box covers how do we get the job done, which, you know, would become, you know, very clearly organizational culture in modern parlance, but at the time that wasn't really a term in vogue. But this is sort of a way of trying to capture all of those different artifacts of what's supposed to help the organization get the job done.
Yeah, well, we already stressed that it's strange that he discusses this element as the last part, while it's in the while you expected maybe leadership as the final element, as it's in the center of the model. But if you look at the text, you might say in one sense he values the mechanisms as the most important aspect, as it signals troubles in the relations between the other boxes, right? So I think that's interesting. And it really, when I read this part towards the end of the article, it also made me think of another scholar. Actually, the structures box already did a bit, but I'm curious if you know what I'm hinting at, Tom or Ralph, if we're talking about structures and coordination mechanisms. No? Well, I was thinking about Structures in Five of Mintzberg when I was reading this article. Okay. Yeah. 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 I mean, the structures we already discussed, but he introduces three configurations, you might say, and a few years later, Mintzberg comes with his five configurations, in which also the mechanisms, the coordination mechanisms, really play an important role in connecting the different structures elements within the organizational configurations. And that's very interesting that he always also addresses this point. And what there was a line on page 443 where he kind of makes a metaphor that connects to your military background. So I'm curious how you view his statements on mechanisms that without helpful mechanisms, organizations will act more like rudderless ships than purposeful men of war.
Oh, I love that one, actually. Yeah, being a Navy guy.
You might say we can have tough soldiers, confident leaders, clear targets, a solid armory, meaningful rewards, an ethical way of dealing with conflicts, right. The military court, but we can still lose the war.
Yes. Well, in fact, there's many good descriptions of army battles where somebody was supposed to go to the front to reinforce and they got lost. Or they got detoured in the woods, and it was a huge impact. You know, this idea that you weren't contributing or didn't have the right sense of direction. And in naval battles, when a ship is rudderless or can't control its rudder, it's a sitting duck for future damage. So usually you have to scuttle it or blow it up or do something, because at that point it's only a danger to itself, it's a danger to everybody else because it lacks this direction. So yeah, I thought that was good. It got my attention right away, this rudderless, although ships don't usually lose their rudder, as in it not existing, they lose the capacity to use a rudder. And I've been reading about some recent surface engagements where just that thing happened and you can't control the ship anymore. And as you said, Michael, if you can't have control of your organization or your ship, are you doing any good, or can you function properly? One other thing I want to say before letting Tom have a chance since I got the battlefield thing in there ahead of him, is Weisberg makes a really interesting observation in this section about the importance of problem-solving vehicles that you might use or might have to create that didn't previously exist when you have problems. Because that makes me think about the Toyota production system. In many ways, Toyota is very open about what they do and their management systems. And occasionally they get asked by consultants or journalists, why do you guys do this? Why do you make it so obvious? And they say, usually the response is, we don't think other organizations can actually follow what we do with the correct discipline, which is the word you used earlier, Michael. And people will get all enamored about these team meetings or these kind of team things Toyota does or some kind of worksheet. And the leaders inside Toyota, whether it's a U.S. plant or a Japanese plant, will say, don't get too carried away about this thing because we created it to solve these kinds of problems. You have to be able to do the same thing yourself. And that's why I think that's a very important point that he makes. And I think it's important. Otherwise, you're going to lose control of your rudder.
Yeah, and it's also interesting the way that in the middle of 444, he talks about what the consultant needs to watch for in this regard, because it's two different types of problems that can surface. One is what he calls the lack of any rational planning, budgeting, control, or measurement systems. That is, in essence, the helpful mechanisms are not particularly well designed. He specifies rational, which means that it's not that those systems don't exist, but they're built around ad hocery. They're built around emotion. They're built around, band-aids or whatever. And then the other part, the second, which he says is worse, is when the organization has all of these, but no goals that the people doing the work agree are organizationally relevant, which is another kind of a way of, I think, of saying that these control mechanisms, these helpful mechanisms, exist for their own purpose. And that's kind of like what we can experience in not the good form of bureaucracy, like Pedro likes to talk about, but the bad kind of bureaucracy, where the processes exist for their own purpose and they don't serve the organization's purpose.
Right, the evil twin, as it were. Because when I was reading that section, I thought, I've been in organizations that had those processes and systems, but they didn't produce outcomes that helped the organization. I mean, they're probably relevant. And they were designed to help you understand, okay, what's your workload? What resources do you have? But they didn't work that way because, I don't really know for sure, but I think it was we didn't have a culture in the organization where people would say, that's not right, or I can't do this, or this is going to be a problem for us. The organization I was in, those were undiscussables. You couldn't even talk about stuff like that. So we'd go to a meeting and have this plan, and I'd come out and say, I can't execute this. I'm stuck now. And I was mystified. And now I realize, okay, you have to look at both aspects, not just do you have the form, but does the form contribute to mission?
Yeah. And, from that passage and what you just said, you can kind of feel the influence of McGregor's book in what Weisberg was talking about, because McGregor talked a lot of this same type of stuff in his discussion of staff and line organizations.
Right. So a quick summary, I think, is that this isn't theoryless. It's the six box model is based on lots of theory, but it's an integration of the theory in a way that both practitioners and, I believe, researchers can understand this very complex thing that we call organizational behavior and the relationships, which Michael emphasized very early on in our conversation, that are essential to making the organization function. And I think it's useful for both consultants and practitioners. If you think about it, in a certain way, you're an internal consultant if you're able to use this, or you're a leader, or you're using it to help diagnose difficulties. And I think it gives you maybe not a roadmap, but a place to start, and a place to start to look for problems or as Weisberg refers to in the article, blips that are indication you've got deeper issues. And I think it's implied. I don't know if he goes in a lot of detail about this, but when you see a blip or you see a problem, dive deeper. Ask those kinds of questions that he talks about. And he gives you some really good ideas how to collect data and dive deeper. And then you'll decide, well, what's important to the organization, what's important to their leaders. How does this connect to the mission and the environment? Those things will emerge. And so he doesn't have to give you all that level of detail. So I think it's great as a place to start.
agree, Ralph, and I'll keep it short. But you mentioned the word roadmap, and I would say it's a navigating tool. So it gives you some ideas on where to start to start diagnosing organizational issues, and especially as I would like to reiterate this, the relationships between the elements that he stresses. That's I think the most interesting part of his article, that it's not necessarily the problems within those boxes, but more between those boxes.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback. So if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.